Hey, it's Bantam, and this is the Digital Song Podcast. It's time to hack destiny. Chapter 40, at least. Mac. The A-Taxi dropped Mac off in front of the entrance to Atavica, the flagship restaurant for the family business.
Atavica, an ancestral throwback,
Mac thought.
What a name for a traditional Italian restaurant.
He laughed to himself and walked through the small double glass doors into the narrow, candlelit restaurant. It was upscale Italian fine dining, white tablecloths, elegant servers in aprons and dress shirts, and beautiful hostesses in black cocktail dresses. The maitre d' stood at the lectern with a host and hostess. She wore a red floral cocktail dress that stopped midway up her thigh, matching deep red lipstick and bobbing curls that bounced when she moved.
Good evening,
she said with a purr.
Hi,
Mac responded.
We've been expecting you, M. Mason,
she said.
Right this way.
She gestured to the hostess standing beside her, who smiled and led Mac down the gap in tables to a booth in the corner where Gio sat. When Gio saw Mac approaching, he stood.
My son.
Gio hugged his son and kissed his forehead, holding Mac's shoulders with his hands.
It's wonderful to see you.
You too, Dad.
Enjoy.
The hostess bowed her head with a closed lip smile, placed the menus upright on the table, and walked away. They ordered drinks and food over small talk. His father seemed to cast a protective aura around them, and it provided a sense of comfort for Mac in his tumultuous life. When entrees arrived a few minutes later, the conversation shifted.
I've been eager to ask you something,
Gio said as he forked the mussels in his pasta.
What's that?
Mac asked as he gulped liquid gold champagne.
I know that your legal troubles were a wake-up call for you. Now that the criminal garbage is behind you, I want you to come back into the fold of the industry. I'm ready to take you on as a partner again so I can eventually pass you the torch. I know your mother would have wanted you to achieve your full potential at the helm of the Mason family restaurant empire.
He put the mussel and pasta on the end of his fork into his mouth, chewed and swallowed before continuing.
The business has suffered for a few years now. We are steeped in litigation and our capital is tied up. Those are the negatives. The positive is that you can turn it around and bring us to great heights.
Mac hesitated imperceptibly as he held the spoonful of risotto. He smelled the scent of truffle and melted cheese in the pillowy rice mound at the same moment that he felt conflicting emotions colliding in his heart like opposite moving waves. On the one hand, being the successor to his father's empire had been his life's goal, and he always wanted to make his mother proud. He wanted to carry on the Mason name with honor, to be the gentleman, the businessman and son that his father expected him to be. On the other hand, Mac resigned himself to the reality that Esri controlled him. She could track him. She knew where he lived. She could end his life, or alternatively, force incomprehensible pain upon him. He felt tethered to her will and whims with no capability of cutting the chain. His final feeling was that maybe he could get out from under Esri's boot heel, maintain his father's love and trust, and still achieve accolades worthy of the Mason name.
All I've got to do is give Esri access to the Pyramid Club's networks and get her the diamond. Then I could put all the horrors behind me and be Dad's business partner,
he thought. Mac put down his utensils as he chewed, dabbing his mouth with his napkin. He conjured up the genuine persona that his father knew.
I can't think of anything else that I want. I want to get back into it and help re-energize the Mason legacy.
Mac held a kernel of hope in his heart that he had the ability, the fortitude, and the foresight to seize the reins after Esri discarded him.
I'm glad to hear it.
His words were succinct, but Gio looked at Mac with unabashed pride and paternal love. Esri had abused Mac, transformed him from a fearful bug into a callous rake with little regard for the feelings of others. But now, looking in his father's eyes, seeing the possible future betrayal of his father's legacy, Mac's scarred, tough, and hedonistic soul softened. Empathy, the feeling of being impacted by the emotions of others, brought with it pain, anger, sadness, and longing, but also hope. His mother's apparition flashed transiently in the light that glinted in the glassiness of Gio's eyes. He could feel Gio studying his face.
Mac, can I ask you something?
He asked softly.
You can ask me anything,
Mac said.
Would you tell me if you needed help with anything at all?
Gio's eyes twinkled.
Yeah, I would. You know I would,
Mac lied.
Good. I'm glad,
Gio said, shoulders relaxing as he continued to eat his meal.
I'm going to tell you something else,
Gio declared after he finished chewing.
All right.
Easton apologized to me for how he treated you at the last Pyramid Club event,
Gio said, still eating.
Good. For a high-end investment and social club, physically accosting a member and pulling them into a back hall isn't right,
Mac said as he reached for his champagne flute.
He told me that he thought you were being threatened and coerced by some kind of hacker or cyber criminal,
Gio said. It took the utmost concentration for Mac not to cough or spew the fizzy delicacy over the dinner table.
Easton knows. How the fuck is that possible?
He thought. Mac had not even known that Ezri had woven a highly sophisticated remote access device into the jacket.
Ezri must be right about the high-level technical capabilities of the Pyramid Club.
I told Easton that your legal case scared you straight,
Gio chuckled.
You're right. I don't want to go back to that life,
Mac responded. Then he gulped the remainder of his champagne to hide his true feelings.
You beat the charges. Jason was a godsend, worthy of every song token I paid him.
Mac nodded his head in agreement.
He gave me a second shot. I could have been rotting in prison for a good portion of my life.
Promise me one thing as my son, future business partner, and heir,
Gio began.
Promise me you will tell me if you're ever in trouble. I can help you. I am your father. I care about you, and you're all I have since your mother passed. I love you. I would protect you with everything I have. You can tell me anything.
Each of his father's words sent a shockwave of shame through Mac's body. His mother's death had injected him with a sense of apathy that he could only overcome with intentionality and deliberate action. Otherwise, he backslid into relying on physical pleasures and comforts to feel alive, which ultimately led to his battle to survive Ezri's tether.
I promise.
He felt the lie cut through his soul like a hot knife through butter. It was a commitment to Ezri over his father. Mac reached across the table and took his father's hand.
No matter what happens, Dad, I love you,
Mac said.
I need you to know that. You raised me right. I screwed up a lot of things, but I do want to make you proud.
Gio smiled, stretching the corners of his mouth.
I love you too, son, no matter what. Fuck up, success. There's literally nothing you could do that would take that away from me.
Relief washed over Mac. All he ever wanted was his father's love and approval. Then, Mac remembered that he owed his life to an insane gangster who was about to introduce violent chaos into his life and the lives of people he knew. His words to his father, though he meant them, turned out to be the most convincing kind of lie. A lie rooted in real emotion. Chapter 41, The Killing Moon, LaDonna. Request 332, WSA 210. Pomodoro accepted the task you submitted to Dark Tasker with the following note. Task will be complete after thorough background research to ensure proper framing. Expected completion within 2 weeks. Price is 20 Bitcoin deposit in Darktasker escrow, which will be released upon completion of the job.
Good,
Chambers thought as she drafted a message.
Targeted theories about a prior Darktasker job have brought negative publicity to my company's brand. When he's gone, his narrative will fizzle out and bad media will cease gaining traction on the socials.
She had been tying her silk necktie in the mirror when the Darktasker notification had come through, with a quiet chime from her computer across her bedroom. She signed into her laptop with her Cryptograph IQ credentials, transferred the 20 Bitcoin to a digital privacy wallet, then forwarded the funds to her obfuscated Darktasker account. When she selected a Darktasker escrow service provider and sent the funds, a verification pop-up window told her the task was now in pending status. She returned to the framed mirror in her walk-in closet and examined herself.
I look like one of the most powerful people in the world.
But sometimes sheer power was insufficient to get what she wanted by the rules. The lawyers had been useless. After explaining why she believed Jason Sola's theories had been slanderous and worthy of a lawsuit, her cadre of counsel had described how such legal action would proceed. The lawyers opined the cause of action would not only be fruitless, but would be expensive, push the allegations into the public spotlight further, and waste everyone's time. She had been aggravated by their impotence, but ultimately dropped the idea. She would have preferred legal recourse, but she needed him silenced somehow. After conducting a cost-benefit analysis, she had determined that eliminating Jason outweighed the risks and the tremendous cost in Bitcoin.
Arbor and Branch are bigger than any individual person. Protecting Arbor is essential to facilitating the evolution of humanity because Branch is the next step in human development. I won't let anyone or anything stand in my way, especially not some scumbag defense attorney.
She nodded at her reflection.
It's almost time to leave for the club.
She set her UD in its charging cradle, strutted into the living room, and grabbed her song program LD to order a car.
Tonight should be the last time I have to see Jason Sola's pathetic face at the Pyramid Club.
Chapter 42. Mercury. Rose. It took Rose 2 hours of focus to achieve stage readiness. She had applied her makeup, curled her hair into bobbing locks that bounced energetically like springs in front of her shoulders. She had donned a black sequin gown that accentuated the shape of her hips and legs. The tattoo of the compass rose hovered above the top of her dress, only partially visible through her corkscrew locks. The Polaris diamond swung lightly from her neck. As she prepared, she thought about Jason.
I wonder if he'll be here tonight.
A potent connection had ignited between her and the newest club member. She remembered the ripple of current that surged through her body when they shook hands, picturing his dark hair, twinkling dark eyes and sloping cheekbones, chin like a smooth round stone induced a mysterious blend of excitement and giddiness.
I'd love to learn more about him.
She visualized her thought lock code and reached for her UD. Even with her special administrative privileges, Rose could not access the interwebs or call anyone, though she enjoyed limited use of applications that did not rely on cellular or 6G signals. As Rose looked at the time on her UD, she had around 2 hours until the performance, she heard a knock at the door.
It's Easton.
Come in.
She craned her neck toward the door to the room.
Hey, Rosebud,
Easton said as he entered. He was wearing a slim black suit and black shirt, which was unbuttoned at the collar. The Pyramid Club pin shimmered on his lapel.
Hi,
Rose said.
Give me a sec.
She was applying her final touch of makeup.
Take your time,
Easton replied. He walked in and sat down on the divan, crossing his right ankle over his thigh. Rose detected an almost imperceptible uneasiness in Easton's voice. Rose finished applying her mascara and turned around to look at Easton.
Are you okay?
I'm fine,
he said.
I'm proud of you.
Thanks.
After a moment, she turned and looked at Easton.
Question.
Shoot.
Can you tell me about the man you introduced me to at the last club event? The criminal defense attorney? Jason? I think I remember seeing him on the socials for a case he worked a few years ago.
I don't know that much about him. Much smaller net worth than other members.
Easton uncrossed his legs.
Don't get me wrong, he seems fine. He's just not our typical member, based on those metrics.
He adjusted his lapel and explained how Gio had beseeched him to offer Jason a membership to the club for representing Max so competently.
From what Gio tells me and from my own brief interactions with him, he seems like an upstanding, friendly, and confident young man. His first event at the club was when you sang the Pyramid song and wore the Polaris diamond for the first time.
Reminded by Easton of its existence, she instinctively reached for the diamond and touched it. She did not always notice how heavy it was. She could see it bob and pull in the mirror on her vanity, shining like a shrunken star around her neck.
I don't know why, but he seems familiar to me.
she said as she reached for a pair of red open-toed stilettos. She walked over to Easton on the divan, and he shifted to give her space to sit down. Rose noticed that Easton's face seemed tense. He seemed to be hiding some secret lugubriousness, and it concerned her.
Seriously, is something bothering you? You can tell me.
He looked at her, smiling warmly, but with detectable sadness in his eyes. He rose from the divan.
I'll be fine.
Rose stood up along with him, and he pulled her into a hug. During the difficult times of her life, Easton's hugs made her feel safe and relaxed. And now, the hug made her feel like the sad teenager whose life was torn apart, then reconstructed by Easton through his affection, love, and surrogate paternity. When they pulled away, Easton continued to hold her shoulders.
No matter what happens, Rose, I love you. I always have, and I always will.
Are you expecting something bad to happen?
Rose asked, surprised by the comment.
You've been acting strange lately. You're speaking in riddles.
No, I'm just saying you can always count on me. I'll always be there for you, even when I'm not. I'm not saying that to be dramatic or to scare you. I'm saying it because I don't say it enough. I love you so much.
He walked toward the door. She smiled, eyebrows raised.
I love you too. I don't know what I would do without you.
Easton turned to Rose, grinning.
Give him hell tonight,
he said, and he walked out of her room. Though Easton had been hiding the knowledge of his impending death from Rose, neither knew that it would be their last time together, face to face. Chapter 43. All You Leave Behind. Easton.
Mac Mason is negative for remote access devices.
Song transmitted mentally.
Thanks,
Easton responded. Hearing the result of the scan relieved him of some of his anxiety. The Pyramid Club patrons mingled in animated conversation all around Easton as he strode purposefully to Mac.
Good evening, Mac. Good to see you,
Easton said, trying to paste a welcoming expression on his face.
You're not going to drag me out of here, are you?
Mac responded. Easton grasped Mac's forearm, the two men's faces only 6 inches apart.
No,
Easton responded.
That whole situation was regrettable. Really, I came over here to apologize and to tell you to enjoy yourself.
Easton maintained his tight grip on Mac's arm, and Mac glanced down at his hand. Easton pulled him closer so he could speak quietly into his ear.
I want to tell you that if you're being coerced or pressured by some criminal gang, or involved in something against your will, you can tell me. I'll keep it to myself.
Easton held Mac's forearm in place so he would not pull away.
You need to know, Mac. We here at the club, me, your father, the other members, we don't think you're a stupid piece of meat.
Easton said, referring to the audio recording song obtained by listening to Mac with his UD before it was inexplicably deactivated. Mac jerked backward, ripping his arm away. He stared at Easton, mouth agape.
You? How the hell do you?
Mac stammered, then stopped himself speaking and seemed to change his facial expression into one of blasé placidity.
You don't know shit.
He turned and walked away without another word.
Keep watch over him,
Easton thought to Song.
Confirmed.
Easton walked around the main reception hall, drifting between conversations. His eyes kept homing in on Mac, who appeared engaged with Mikhail Fodor and Brax Holland, smiling and gesticulating as he spoke. A gentle but firm hand squeezed Easton's shoulder.
Looks like you could use a drink, you old graybeard,
the smooth voice rumbled.
Maybe it's time to pour that champagne you owe me.
Easton turned around to see Gio holding a stemless glass bulb of red wine next to Jason Sola.
Welcome to the night's festivities, you rascal.
I don't mean to be discourteous, but you look a little out of sorts. Anything I can help you with?
His expression of concern accentuated the hairline wrinkles around his eyes and flat, tense mouth. Easton tried to inject authenticity into his forced smile.
I'm fine,
he said.
And yes, I need to open that bottle I promised you.
He turned toward Jason.
You've been an active member. It's nice to see.
It's easy to be here. I feel like somehow this place will give me something positive to do,
Jason said.
I've wandered around for years without knowing what I wanted out of life, but now I'm starting to think it's here.
I hope it is.
Unrelated.
Jason turned to look at Easton and continued,
but I wanted to thank you for the introduction to Rose.
My pleasure.
After tonight's performance, I'm going to request a couple songs to her that I think would showcase her voice.
She has been known to take recommendations,
Gio said.
I love Springsteen, so a few years ago I asked her to play a song of his and she obliged. She's kept it in the repertoire. I even heard it recently.
Jason nodded in acknowledgement.
She seems like an interesting person. My assumption is that this isn't her full-time job.
Easton shook his head.
No. She put herself through business school. She's a finance whiz, and her day job is working as a consultant.
He paused, more dramatically than he intended.
I've known her for a long time. She's like a daughter to me. Since she was a young girl, she was destined for stage performance, so I'm so glad she's devoted her personal time singing for us here at the club. It's what keeps people coming back, let's be honest.
He turned to Gio.
It's not the food that brings them back since you stopped catering for us, am I right?
The two men laughed.
When the club first began, one of my catering companies helped get the dinner segment up and running,
Gio recounted.
Mac even ran the operation. It was stellar. Then this guy,
he pointed to Easton with his thumb,
found his own executive chef, and the food went downhill. Fast.
Have you eaten at one of his restaurants?
Easton asked Jason, referring to Gio.
The food is fit for the Olympian gods.
I'm not sure.
Gio patted Easton on the shoulder.
Thanks, you old kiss-ass.
He gestured at Jason with the hand holding the bulb of wine.
Jason, after what you did for my son, you are considered a VIP at any of the family restaurants. You must go to Joie de Vivre or Atavica. You'd be welcome to a 5-course dinner on the house.
Atavica is one of my favorites,
Easton declared.
Rose prefers Ambrosia in Brooklyn, but I'm old school. I like the dressed-up servers with aprons and tablecloths. She likes the quaint, modern bistro feel over the traditional fine dining ambience.
Easton noticed how captivated Jason became when he talked about Rose. He detected a similar energy from Rose when she had asked about Jason. Easton looked at his screen band.
Gents, forgive me, it's been a pleasure, but I must talk to some of the other guests before dinner and the investment presentations begin.
The three men exchanged perfunctory valedictions, and Easton left to speak with other club members in the crowd. After a few additional minutes talking with patrons while suppressing his discomfort at Mac's presence in the club, Easton heard the auditory ripple from the light strike of a gong. It crescendoed softly until it rumbled through the main reception hall, signaling to the patrons that it was time to commence the dining and presentation segment of the evening in the setting hours of the sun and Easton's life. Chapter 44. Pain. Rose. When the investment presentations ended, the lights in the main hall dimmed to darkness. Rose walked onto the stage with her bandmates in the spotlight, and each took his or respective place. The deep purr of a vaguely female voice began to speak over the hum of conversation.
And now, Compass Rose.
The room burst into applause, which Rose could hear and feel as the spotlight encircled her as she stood at the microphone.
This song is by a band called The War on Drugs. I hope you like it.
She said into the mic as the guitarist picked arpeggiated chords, the drums carried the rhythm, and the upright bass reinforced the melody with deep drones. She saw Jason seated 3 tables back from the stage. His eyes, fixed upon her, flashed a piercing glint, and she could not avert her gaze from his. It was like an opaque smoke had dropped like a curtain around everything else in the room except for the sight line between the two of them. She could only focus on him, and he appeared to only focus on her. She could not tell what kind of connection it was. Sexual? Emotional? Nostalgic? But as she sang, he was the only audience member that mattered. She closed her eyes and danced around the stage during the melodious guitar interlude.
How does this man who makes me feel electric fit into my life?
The song projected from her lungs. The lyrics seemed to tell the story of their connection, how the future would unfold for them, how the past had brought them together. The final solo of the guitar was like a yearning arm, outstretched and grasping for hope, praying for salvation in the unknown future. Rose had closed her eyes to let the guitar wail the final melody, and she twirled and made a chopping motion with her hand that coincided with the final drum beat, bass tone, and guitar chord. Rose pulled out of her musical trance to see the audience members' faces stricken with bewilderment, clapping for the performance. She felt the swing of the Polaris diamond around her neck, tapping the left side of her collarbone, then the right side, then the left again. Rose smiled. A magical wind seemed to gust and roll between Rose and the bandmates and the people in the audience. And Jason. He gazed with the same intensity with which he had watched her performance. He was clapping, eyes wide and unblinking, seemingly entranced. The musical act had cosmically marked the end of a tranquil and stable period of her life, and her bow would bring her headfirst into a chaotic future of revelation. Chapter 45. Quicksand. Rose. She flanked her bandmates in the main reception hall during post-performance drinks. As patrons sipped espresso, dessert wines, or sparkling rosé, they churned around the band in a crowd heaping praise on them. As Rose spoke to LaDonna Chambers, she noticed that most patrons had left, and all that remained was a small gathering of around 15 people, including Gio and Mac Mason, Christina Da Costa, and Camille Sandeni. Jason stood alone after Rui Meir and Florian Silver departed. Rose thanked Chambers and excused herself so she could talk to Jason. As she approached him, he smiled and swirled the glass in his hand, garnet fluid spiraling around a spherical bubble of ice. The Pyramid Club pin glinted on his lapel.
Good to see you again,
Jason said, eyes fixed on her. The intense look from Jason made her feel like she was the only person in the room, in the city, in the world, in that moment.
You too.
Rose replied, returning the slight smile. Strangely, she felt a warmth in her chest, as if she had known him for a long time.
Have we met before? I mean, before last time?
Rose asked.
I can't help but feel like I know you.
Jason squinted slightly as if he were thinking.
You think we've met?
I'm not sure. I know I've seen you in news coverage of the Darden trial, but that's all I can think of.
Jason shook his head.
I don't think we've ever met before. I'm fairly certain of that.
How do you know?
Wait.
He paused, then wrinkled his nose and furrowed his brow.
Have you ever gone to jail?
No.
Been arrested?
No.
That's probably why.
He shrugged.
I spend most of my time around criminals.
Oh, okay.
Rose rolled her eyes and gently punched his shoulder. She liked the irreverence of his quip and the self-deprecation in his humor.
I don't think we've met. I remember people's faces, and I would certainly have been able to remember yours.
Thanks,
Rose said. She bit her lower lip.
I probably would have recognized you, too.
I also think I would remember your pretty unique ink,
Jason said, pointing at her compass rose tattoo.
Besides the obvious connection to your name, what's it signify?
Rose instinctively touched her tattoo. She could feel her heart beating slightly faster than normal.
It's a long story.
I'd love to hear it,
Jason said. Her painful life story tumbled out of her mouth before her mind realized it.
My mom left when I was a kid. Then, when I was a teen, my dad died in a car crash. Why am I telling him my personal history right now? I barely know him.
Whoa, I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's been years. At the time, I was devastated. It turned my world upside down. I felt like I couldn't tell how to move forward with my life, or whether I'd ever find happiness again, like I'd be alone forever.
She breathed deeply.
Anyway, I moved in with Easton after my dad passed. He's my uncle, my dad's brother. He basically took on the father figure role from that day onward. He was the one who encouraged me to be a singer. He used to say, "Your voice is so powerful, it could guide a ship out of a storm." Imagine hearing that when you're a teenager without parents. It made me feel amazing. It made me think of a compass, something that directs people to where they need to go when they're uncertain.
"Compass Rose,"
Jason said softly.
"Yeah,"
she said, as she pushed a lock of hair behind her ear.
It's so weird to say aloud. I haven't spoken about it with anyone in years. As I got older, the nickname made me feel like I had control over my life, like I had the capacity to steer myself where I wanted to go.
"I'm glad you told me. It's an incredible story. You're a survivor."
After a moment's pause, Jason changed the subject.
"So how did you get involved with the club?"
"Easton said he needed a singer. He asked me first. I accepted, obviously, but I was so happy he asked."
"Well, you're killing it. The music's the best part."
"It sounds like you like it here,"
Rose said.
"I love it, but it's a little intimidating sometimes. There are famous people here that I've read about on the socials or in Forbes. I'm not wealthy or accomplished in the way they are. I'm just a simple criminal defense attorney. I mean, I chatted with Brax Holland the other day. It was surreal. I may have been starstruck the whole time."
"I'm going to tell you a secret,"
Rose leaned toward Jason.
"Even though he gives off a player vibe, Brax is nerdy."
Jason raised his eyebrows.
"No way, for real? I'd never have guessed."
"It's true. He told me he can't find anyone to play RPGs with him in the metaverse,"
she said, referring to role-playing games.
"He invited me to play, but it's not my thing. That's one of the most interesting parts of the Pyramid Club. All the famous people who are members, they're just people. They come here to be themselves and to escape all the scrutiny that comes with fame."
"Makes sense. I don't know how they handle the unending attention."
Rose felt at ease as she talked with Jason. It was like they were in a bubble together, insulated from any distraction. They bantered and joked and laughed as the guests departed in a swirl, not realizing that around the eddy in time they created together in that moment, the currents of the fourth dimension rushed past them in whooshes, splashes, and waves. Without warning, Jason shifted the topic of discussion.
"I was thinking about what you just said about the compass as a symbol representing control over your life. Does that mean you don't believe in fate?"
Jason asked. The question surprised Rose.
"I'm not sure,"
Rose responded, looking at Jason.
"No, I don't think I do."
She looked around at the elegant decor of the reception hall. The servers had cleared out and only she and Jason remained, along with Mac Mason and Christina DaCosta, who were speaking in the corner of the room.
"Some things I can control and others I can't, but either way, it all comes down to chance. Why? Do you?"
"I didn't used to, but I'm starting to. That's a longer story for another time, though."
He looked at his watch.
"This place looks like it's about to close. I don't want to scare you away with my strange questions."
"You're not scaring me,"
Rose said.
"But we are shutting down for the night, and I have stuff to take care of before I jet."
She looked at Jason. Their sight lines aligned perfectly. She hoped that he would capitalize on the opening.
"You have an energy that makes me feel at ease, and I would love to talk with you again."
"Me too."
Rose could feel a diffuse warmth in her limbs and core. Jason grinned, and his cheeks flushed red.
"How about I give you my UD info and we can catch up over coffee or a drink somewhere in the next week or two before the next Pyramid Club event?"
"Sure."
Jason turned and set his bourbon tumbler onto a bar top table nearby and pulled out a moleskin notepad and a pen.
"Wow, who carries a pen and paper around anymore?"
Rose teased.
"The lawyer's two weapons are the pen and the word,"
Jason said as he handed her his arsenal.
"And though I try to keep pace with tech, I have old school tendencies."
She flipped through the notebook, seeing doodles and hastily written notes, undecipherable and contextless words and glyphs. She found an empty page and drew a simplified thumbnail picture of her Compass Rose tattoo, then wrote her UD number in Rose next to it. She slid it over to Jason and showed him.
"Here, I added a compass next to my name so you can find me again.
Now there's no way I'll lose you,
he said, staring at her doodle.
Now there's no way I'll lose you.
It was an unusual but romantic response that intrigued Rose. She could not tell if he meant it to sound so dramatic or if he was just carrying along the joke.
When I get home and have access to my UD, I'll send you a text with my info.
That'd be great.
For a moment, the two stood facing each other until Jason leaned forward, putting one arm around her. She reciprocated and wrapped her arms around the top of his back, feeling the musculature of his shoulders. She liked being protectively blanketed by his arms and body.
Good night, Rose,
he said, then kissed her gently on her cheek. She felt his warm breath as he pulled away. The intimacy of the moment injected her with both desire and comfort.
I hope to see you soon,
she said as they separated, her heart beating rapidly.
Me too.
Chapter 46. Violet City. Mac watched Jason and Rose talking out of the corner of his eye as Christina Da Costa told him about a trip she had taken on a yacht down the Amazon. He glanced at his watch, 11:52 p.m., as Da Costa described the jungle wildlife.
We got lucky nobody was hurt. It was a bad situation we put ourselves in. You know what they say in Brazil? Now da sorte a azar.
What's that mean?
Don't give good luck to misfortune.
Mac was distracted and anxious. It was the night of his betrayal and hopefully his salvation. He tried to act normal, calm. His eyes scanned the hall.
Fascinating.
He cleared his throat.
It's looking like it's time to get out of here. Everyone else has left.
Da Costa looked around.
Why, yes, you're right. I suppose it's time to leave, but you must hear what happened.
She gave the final details of her story to Mac as they slowly walked toward the exit together. He acted interested, but only listened with minimal amounts of attention.
I'm glad Dad won't be here for this,
he thought. 11:56 p.m. As Da Costa approached the large security door, Mac slid it open for her chivalrously. He saw the two security guards still posted in the brick corridor between the outside entrance to the club and the reception hall.
I have to grab something inside, but hopefully I'll see you soon.
A pleasure, Mac. Muito prazer, as usual.
Da Costa said in English and Portuguese. When he looked back, nobody remained in the reception hall. The emptiness of the room signaled that it was time to act.
When I do this, Ezri will finally let me go, and I'll be a free man again.
He yearned for the day that he would be out from under her boot heel.
11:59 p.m. Fuck, it's time.
He trotted past the large steel slab door down the entry corridor, past the two security guards. One of the two guards, Thomas, had been present when Easton had accused him of working for a criminal. He had reason to be concerned, after all.
Good night,
Max said to the two security guards.
Good night, M. Mason,
the female guard replied. The male guard nodded in acknowledgement. Mac knew that the door to the outside entrance was closed and locked. After he exited, it would shut and seal automatically. He would have to hold it open. He reached the door and pulled it open. As the door opened, a black Lincoln Navigator squealed to a halt outside it. Fast and as stealthily as a trained military commando, Ezri jumped out of the SUV and burst through the red door dressed in black slacks, black t-shirt, and black boots, with a slim backpack strapped to her back. Her eyes shined like golden discs. She glided by Mac as if he were not even there, with two large men flanking her. Mac recognized them as her security at Disco Ardent and her condo. A loud yet muffled staccato rap-pap-pap rang through the hallway, accompanied by bright flashes. Mac looked down the corridor, frozen as the two club security guards toppled to the ground, splotches of wine-dark blood plastered against the brick wall behind them, and running in rivulets down the partially opened, bright steel door. Looking at Ezri's arm, lifted parallel to the ground, Mac saw she held a submachine gun with an extended clip protruding downward from the grip, and a wide cylinder over the muzzle like a black tennis ball can, skinny plumes of smoke twisting out of it.
Good Christ,
Mac gasped.
Nothing beats tough cybersecurity like an Uzi,
Ezri said aloud.
Couldn't let them escape through that big security door.
She looked over her shoulder at Mac, who had sunk to his knees in shock.
Mac, come here,
she demanded, without remorse or feeling, pointing the Uzi at Mac.
Can't have you leave in the middle of the fun part.
Mac tremulously stood, then slid slowly toward Ezri and her two henchmen, knees wobbling. He had never seen a dead body, except in the context of a thoughtfully curated open casket funeral for his mother, and he had not been prepared to see violent death that night. His face had turned a lifeless matte pallor.
Chop chop, Mac,
Ezri said with levity, standing in the threshold to the reception hall. When he reached her, she forcefully grabbed him, then pushed him past the blood-spattered steel door.
Where would the computers controlling the network be?
Ezri grabbed Mac's shirt collar, twisted it, and yanked him down, bringing his face closer to hers. She held the muzzle of the gun upward under his chin.
I don't know. I've never seen any computers. I already told you everything I know.
Mac squealed.
Where do we go, for fuck's sake?
Ezri yelled in Mac's face.
You could go to that side hallway right there,
Mac pointed.
Or through to the main dining hall and performance stage through there. But I don't know. I don't know where anything else is.
Ezri looked away from Mac and exhaled a sigh, making her lips vibrate.
Mazzy, Ballard, with me,
she said to the two muscular men, who nodded. She reached in her waistband and pulled out a black pistol.
Here,
she said, tossing it to Mac, who bobbled it like it was scalding to the touch.
Find me that diamond, and this time don't get caught red-handed with the gun.
She turned and trotted down toward the performance hall doors with her two guards beside her, leaving Mac trembling, staring at the cold metal mechanism of death in his grip. Thanks for listening to the Digital Song Podcast. Please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. All writing is 100% original and human imagined and created by me, Bantam Drexler. All editing and audio engineering done by me. Original music by me, augmented by Suno. Podcast voice audio generated using 11 Labs. Copyright Bantam Drexler. Follow me on any of the socials, at Bantam Drexler, or check me out at bantamdrexler.com. See you in the future.